Support for this KQED podcast comes from Bay Meadows, an urban village in San Mateo. Fitness and movies in the park, Caltrain, artisan eateries, fun for the kids, all just a hop from your front door. Homes now selling and leasing, baymeadows.com.
What happens when your mother tells you this?
I don't care what you guys do in your life, as long as you're not a drug addict, a criminal, or a homosexual.
It's Stories from the Leap, a new podcast from KQED, launching October 6th.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. On July 17, 1944, explosions at the Port Chicago Naval Facility near Concord killed 320 men. 202 of them were African-American sailors who were assigned to loading munitions into cargo ships. White sailors were granted 30 days leave after the incident, while African-American sailors were ordered back to work. 50 sailors refused. They were convicted of mutiny and sentenced to 15 years in prison. Today, Bay Area lawmakers are joining advocates in urging President Obama to exonerate these men. And joining us for this half hour are David Salniker. He's founding board member and treasurer of the Friends of Port Chicago National Memorial. David Salniker, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Mina.
Also joining us is J. Vern Crumity, professor of sociology at Contra Costa College. Vern Crumity, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
David Salniker.
Invite me.
Oh, you're welcome. We're glad to have you. And David Salniker, if I could start with you. You are part of the Friends of Port Chicago National Memorial and have been a historian on this. What do we know about the men, who they were, what made them stand up for themselves in this way?
Well, in many ways, they were probably not unusual. What's so remarkable about them is that they were mostly teenagers and in their young 20s. They were anxious to serve in the military. They were anxious to defend the country. And what I don't think we realize is the military was deeply segregated at the time, and the Navy was very restrictive about what jobs they would assign to black sailors and soldiers. So they were assigned tasks like ammunition loaders at Port Chicago and at other bases, and they were used as essentially messmen. I don't think they were remarkable in any sense until they began suffering the impact of the deep segregation that took place. And as events unfolded, they began to protest and organize as a result of the explosion.
Vern Crumity, your father was stationed at Mare Island at the time of the explosion in 1944?
No, my father was actually stationed at Camp Knight, and before that he was stationed at Camp Stoneman. He joined the military in 1942, and he stayed there until 1946. And initially, after he had his basic training, he was sent to Alabama for a short time, and then in 1943 he was sent to Camp Stoneman, and that same year he was transferred to Camp Knight.
I see.
So when the explosion happened on July 17, 1944, that was his 22nd birthday. That was his birthday.
Wow.
So he was on 7th Street in Oakland when it happened, and then he said military policemen came around and told them all to report back to their duty stations, which he did do, which was in Oakland. And then the next day, they told him to go over. They went over to Port Chicago to help out with the cleanup and the like.
What did your father see when he went there to help with the cleanup?
He said he saw sheer destruction. He said he saw there were buildings had been destroyed, partly destroyed. He said he saw pieces of bodies all around. And like that's one of the first times I ever see my father cry. And he was telling me about that. And this happened in 1976. I had gone home. And I was in the Navy, and I had gone home, and then he asked me, say, son, where are you stationed now? I told him I was stationed at Mare Island. Then he told me, say, at one point, I was stationed out there, and he said, when I was out there, this base blew up, and then he began to tell me the story of Port Chicago, and that was the second time I heard it mentioned. The first time was in boot camp, when I was going through boot camp, and they talked about Port Chicago in the context of teaching us about the UCMJ, which is the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And they was talking about how these 50 men had been court-martialed at one time. And that was kind of like a threat and a warning to us as trainees.
Why do you think your father waited till 1976 to talk to you about it? What effect do you think it had had on him?
Well, after reading Robert's book, Robert Allen's book, who was a fellow sociologist, I really began to understand the context. Very few of the men, even of the 50 men who got court-martialed, they rarely talked to their families about that while they were alive. It was very, very rare. And it was kind of like, so they may talk to other military people about issues like that, but oftentimes they were not. Now that I'm a college professor, oftentimes I teach a lot of military vets. They come into my classrooms, and a lot of times they would talk to me, but they won't talk to others because they feel there's a type of bond there. So when I told my father I was stationed at Mare Island, that's when he opened up to me and told me about what he had seen. So given that situation, I'm not surprised. Now, at that time, when he was telling me the story, I didn't probe him. I didn't follow up with any questions. I didn't say anything because I was basically stunned as we sat on the porch of my grandmother's house when he told me about it. But now I'll have many questions I could present to him. But he's deceased. He died in 1983 of lung cancer.
I'm sorry. David Zoniker, you know, Vern Cromartie helps me think about the experiences that the 50 men must have had. I mean, how long did they serve in prison?
Well, they were granted clemency at the end of the war by President Truman, but I would most of them served from 18 months to 2 years. The clemency was conditioned that they then serve on naval ships overseas for another year. It was not just the 50 men. There were originally 258 men who refused the order to go back to loading ships until there had been an investigation into the cause of the accident and changes in working conditions for these men. 200 of them eventually decided to go back to work. But these men were court-martialed as well, and they were given three-month jail sentences, and they were given general discharges. So I think Vern's right. All of these men felt stigmatized by their convictions and were very reluctant to tell their families or to tell their stories. Really, the uproar that took place afterwards was generated by Thurgood Marshall and Eleanor Roosevelt primarily, and the so-called liberal press that really campaigned against the segregation in the military. And the events eventually led to the desegregation of the Navy, who immediately after the convictions and the uproar decided to integrate the munitions loading and provide training, which they had never done before, to these young men, and training to officers, who were also not trained. So the effect was immediate on the military, for these men.
Yeah, they played a powerful role in ultimately desegregating the military. But at the time, as you mentioned, they were granted clemency a couple of years later. But clemency is not exoneration. What would exoneration mean to the families who are linked to this Port Chicago disaster?
Exoneration, none of the men are still alive. So in many ways, exoneration is symbolic. I compare it to the lowering of the Confederate flag in South Carolina. It is a symbol of the Jim Crow era that these convictions still stand. And it is a dishonor to these men who were absolutely patriotic in their willingness to serve their country, even in these very difficult jobs and under very difficult conditions. So I think, first and foremost, there is a symbolic significance both for the civil rights movement and for these men and their families themselves. As Vern pointed out, many of them were ashamed to talk about their convictions. Second, there is probably a real benefit to having exoneration, and the military benefits initially to the survivors and their families, to the mutineers, quote unquote, and their families. And so that would probably have a monetary effect for the families. But most importantly, it would be a healing event, a restorative justice event. And I think that's most important for all of us.
We're talking with David Salniker, founding board member and treasurer of the Friends of Port Chicago National Memorial, and also Vern Crumity, professor of sociology at Contra Costa College. What do you remember about the tragedy at Port Chicago, the stand that was taken by these men? What are your thoughts on the effort to exonerate them? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org, post them on Facebook or on our website, kqed.org/forum. Vern Crumity, I was struck by something you said earlier about wanting to ask your father so many questions, and also by what David Salniker is saying about how these men kept it in and didn't want to talk about their experience. Could I ask you, what was your father's reaction to the conviction?
He said it was totally wrong what happened to those young men. And he would... So I agree, and I agree with David's position. I totally agree, support exoneration. And I think my father would have supported exoneration too, because he said at that time in 1976, it was wrong what happened to those men, and they should never have been court-martialed for that.
And
that was his position. And, that was his position.
And as someone, you are a naval officer, you're a veteran as well. I mean, what would it have been like? What is the experience of being court-martialed? I mean, you know, what kind of effect does that have?
Devastating. Devastating. I served in the military for 9 years. I was enlisted, a petty officer. I was enlisted. And I saw countless acts of racism. And I know I stand on the shoulders of those men at Port Chicago when we were given broader opportunities than they had. So I understand that clearly. And so they helped for example, they helped to desegregate the Navy and the other branches. They were the first ones. So I really appreciate the sacrifices that they made. But I think the country would do well by seeing those men have their records exonerated at this point and cleared. Because I agree with Robert that it was not a mutiny. It was a work stoppage, at the very most a strike.
David Salniker.
A mutiny is considered an attempt to assert power over a superior officer. There was none of that. There was no violence by these young men. They simply engaged in a work stoppage, asking for an investigation into the working conditions and for increased training before they went back to work loading ammunition. So it's just...
Mm-hmm.
It's impossible to think of this as a mutiny, but it was not. If you talk to military historians, particularly those who focused on the issue of racial injustice in the military, it was not unusual for black sailors and soldiers to face much more intense charges of disobedience than white sailors or soldiers.
David Salniker, founding board member and treasurer of the Friends of Port Chicago National Memorial. Let's hear what our listeners have to say. Jane in Corte Madera. Hi, Jane.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I was 14 years old when Port Chicago happened, so I really don't have any memory of it. I lived in the East Bay, and I'm just sitting here listening to your show, and it's so obvious to me that this is nothing more than pure, unadulterated racism. The military was segregated in those days. I believe that the military figured, well, let's use people who are expendable to do the dangerous jobs because we want to save our white guys and I don't know what other color people were in the service at the time, but I assume that it was made up mostly of white guys. And it's just a classic example of the racism that went on in this country even as late as the 70s and the 80s, and it just infuriates me that this happened. And I congratulate the people that are involved in this activity, and I hope that all the families of those poor men will get everything due to them going all the way back to 1944, every penny, every medical care, everything that they're due as members of our armed forces. And I'm proud of every single one. I am a white lady, obviously. It just makes me so unhappy. It makes me so sad to think that our country could have been involved in what we were involved in treating those men that way.
Jane, thanks so much for the call. What options, David Sonlinger, does the president have before him to try and exonerate these men?
Well, to be absolutely clear, that's not clear. It's not clear if the president has the power rather than the Navy itself for exonerating these men. He could certainly issue a proclamation that would remove the stain on their reputations, and we hope he does at least that. We think he can order the Navy to exonerate these men. The Navy did hold a proceeding in 1994, and even though it found that the trial was filled with racial prejudice at its time, it refused to overturn these convictions. So
that would not be in a route that he would take again, or has enough time passed since 1994 that it might yield a different result?
It might yield a different result, but it might be also very time-consuming. So we're hoping he issues an executive order that proclaims the exoneration. And a little bit of this is being left to the White House staff and the attorneys involved to see what is the best path for moving this forward. But the momentum that has been caused recently by local congressional delegations, particularly Mark DeSaulnier, who succeeded George Miller, and George Miller has been a champion of this cause for over 20 years, Barbara Lee's efforts, and now the two senators, we're assuming this will be very effective in getting the White House's attention.
Vern Cromartie, is the momentum you're seeing now to exonerate these men unique in your view? Do you have optimism that it will finally happen?
I'm very optimistic. I am so proud of the fight that George Miller has waged over the years. And I live in Contra Costa County, so I've been so proud to vote for him over the years because he's been a stalwart. Now that Mark DeSaulnier has replaced him, I hope that he continues this fight because it's important. I think it's very, very important. As a military veteran, I definitely see it's the right thing to do and the right thing to occur. I hope that the president does issue some type of proclamation toward this effect and maybe even order the Navy to exonerate the men. That would be wonderful, too, because that would be the right thing to do.
And let's go to more calls. Stephen in Sunol. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. It's in old California. Yep.
Thanks, Stephen. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. Great show. I wanted to mention a gentleman named Captain Hugh Mulzak, who was the only African-American to command a Liberty ship. He was a master of a Liberty ship in World War II, totally under the radar gentleman. It was an integrated ship, and basically after the war with McCarthy and everything, they ruined him. They took his Seaman's papers, totally under the radar. You can look him up. And I did a FOIA on him. There's like 5,000 pages that the FBI has, and they're not giving them up. It said it'll take a couple of years to declassify it. But it ties in with this, and this story's fascinating. And it's his book, autobiography, is called A Star to Steer By. And reader or the listeners probably like it. Ties in with this. It's another travesty that went on.
Well, thanks so much for sharing that. I appreciate it. Let's go to Doug in San Jose. Hi, Doug.
Hi, good morning. I'm 80 years old, and I remember this incident quite well. I had a man as a teacher in junior high school. John Belucci was his name, and he was an officer in charge out there.
At Port Chicago.
Yes, at that time. And he was instrumental in what was going on and keeping the control of the the people out there and so on and so forth. And he was a very, very overbearing type of person.
So you mean
I can remember one time during a class we had in junior high school, one of the boys wasn't paying attention, and he took a blackboard eraser and just lobbed it across the room and hit this kid with.
And so this was the person who would have been involved in ordering folks back to work?
Yeah, that's John DeLucchi, yes.
Well, thanks for sharing your memory. How were you affected by this disaster?
Well, I learned all about this later on. I saw it on television, and, you know, and I saw, then I realized who the man was and that I had had him for teacher and everything like that, you know. And then it all kind of seemed to fall into place, the disposition that this man DeLucchi had, so on and so forth.
Well, Doug, thanks for sharing your memory. I really appreciate it. David Sonnecker, why is there a danger that exoneration won't happen? And what would be the reason it wouldn't? I mean, are there objections to this anywhere?
We have not heard any objections. And what's remarkable about this effort, and I want to pay compliments to the San Francisco Veterans Affairs Commission, has joined with us in seeking exoneration, and they have reached out to Veterans Group, and they also reached out to the congressional delegation. And so I think having veterans participate in this does make a difference. There's always a danger exoneration won't take place. Bill Clinton pardoned one of the sailors about 20 years ago, and the rest of the sailors who were those that were alive at the time, did not want to pardon because it assumed guilt.
It doesn't wipe out the conviction, right? Pardon does not do that. Yeah,
exactly. So there's always a danger that there will not be full exoneration. But I think the momentum has grown ever since we held a symposium a year ago that featured military historians. And a lot of these issues have resurfaced in the press. There's been wonderful support for exoneration. And next year is the 100th anniversary of the Park Service, and the Port Chicago Memorial was President Obama's first national park, which he signed into law in 2009. And so we're hoping that he might actually come out for the 100th anniversary and we can celebrate the exoneration with him together. That would be our ideal.
Well, Vern Cremonti, you know, when you teach this experience to students, we're hearing from people who remember it. Are the students aware of it?
No. As a matter of fact, most of them would say that, tell me that the first time they ever heard of Port Chicago was in my classroom. So I normally show some documentaries. I show a Hollywood feature film called Mutiny about it. And KRON made a wonderful documentary about it, and I show that along with some other films from time to time. So as an educator, I think it's important that we deal with the social history of the local area so that people know about it, where they live, that what has happened here. And I think Port Chicago is a very, very important part of the social history of Contra Costa County and the Bay Area as a whole.
Yet, in this movement to try to exonerate these men, Vern Cremonti, there's been allusions to the fact that an exoneration would help to somehow, you know, ameliorate or to mitigate the current sort of racial strife that we have right now, the issues that have really come to the fore. Do you think it would have that effect, Vern Cremonti?
I think it would definitely be a step in the right direction. Absolutely. When I was in the military, sadly, the Navy was known as the most racist branch of the military. And it continued. That legacy continued. When I was in, I think there was a study done by Alfonso Pinckney, who was a sociologist at Harvard. And I think he said something like 25% of black men were not receiving honorable discharges. They was getting less than, including BCDs and the like. You know, so I think this would be a step in the right direction.
Thank you.
Because there have been a lot of people that have been hurt by racism in the military and the like. Many, many people, especially black men.
Vern Crumity, professor of sociology at Contra Costa College. Let's go to Spencer in Oakland. Hi, Spencer.
Hello. Good morning. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
My father was Spencer Sykes Sr. First of all, I want to say hello to David Salnicker. He's doing an outstanding job.
Hi, Spencer.
and thank you to KQED for bringing this to the public's attention. Dad was stationed at Port Chicago, and one would probably conclude that love and respect was his savior, was what kept him alive. He was on base at the time, received a phone call from a young lady he had been courting in Berkeley, and she wanted to go to a movie, and he wasn't really feeling it and said that he didn't want to go. Her mother got on the phone and basically said to him, "Sykes, take my daughter to the movie." "Yes, ma'am." So, out of respect, he took off and went to take the young lady to a movie. And shortly thereafter, during the film, the floor vibrated and the lights flickered, and a voice came over the loudspeaker asking if there were any enlisted men from Port Chicago to return immediately. And my father was part of that group that went back. And as he described it, when he arrived, there were body parts everywhere. And they were, in fact, ordered to go back and clean up the mess. And I recall him telling me that he reached down to pick up a shoe and still had a foot in it.
Wow.
So, you know, you can imagine the trauma, the stress, post-traumatic stress disorder, I don't think was diagnosed back in those days. And subsequent therapy was unheard of. So his way of dealing with it was to tell the story. And we heard it over and over and over again. But I'm grateful to have been able to hear it, and now to be able to support Friends of Port Chicago and Congressman Martin Salmier in their efforts.
Well, Spencer, thanks so much for the call. And thank you, David Salnicker, for joining us. And good luck on your efforts. David Salnicker, founding board member and treasurer of the Friends of Port Chicago National Memorial. My thanks also to Vern Crumity, professor of sociology at Contra Costa College. Thanks for the work that you do to try to share this story with your students and for sharing the experience of your father today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mina.
Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Susan Britton, and Suki Lewis. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and this week it's Howard Gelman. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our interns are Jeremy Spiegel and Latoya Tools, and our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.